You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Kaden Tokawingawa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pārē Thursday. My name is Kaden, I'm your host for today and I'll be with you for the next hour. FIRKNA coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Arena Williams about phase two of the COVID-19 inquiry and advisory group recommendations on climate adaptation legislation. For International's Desk, I spoke to Charles Hunt from Boise State University about United States President Donald Trump's Big Beautiful Bill. Sarah, what have you got for us today?
For this week's City Counselling, I spoke with Councillor Shane Henderson about Mayor Wayne Brown's recent council body reforms, as well as concerns around homelessness in the CBD this winter. Regarding phase two of the COVID-19 inquiry, I spoke with both Restaurant Association Chief Executive Marissa Bidois and public health expert Sir Colin Tukui Tonga.
He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e wareware ia hiana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, he pakehere rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party's Carmel Cipollone.
Public hearings as part of phase two of the Royal Commission into COVID-19 took place in Auckland this week. Phase two of the inquiry focuses on the impact of the long lockdowns in Auckland and Northland on businesses, organisations and individuals. Phase two of the inquiry was launched by the current government following the completion of the Labour Party's original inquiry. The second phase of the inquiry has a stronger focus on lockdowns, vaccine mandates and the impact of the COVID-19 response across business and the economy. And yesterday, an independent reference group set up by the Ministry of Environment shared their recommendations for climate adaptation legislation. A notable recommendation was to phase out government assistance for property buyouts following damage from extreme weather events. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Arena Williams about both of these topics. I started by asking what her response is to phase two of the inquiry.
I think it was a really difficult time for New Zealanders, as it was for people all around the world, and I want to start by acknowledging that. Thinking about it as how we move forward as a country is important. Chris Atkins has said he's going to give evidence for the inquiry like he did for the first run. I think there are recommendations from the last inquiry which haven't been actioned yet, and they should be, and that's where the focus should be. And yeah, it's worth reflecting on this next part, how New Zealand's response saved a lot of lives and livelihoods, and that we should all be learning from it so that we can do better next time.
Chris Hipkins has expressed some concerns about the terms of reference for the inquiry, as saying it provides a platform for conspiracy theorists. Is that also your view?
I think his concern about the terms of reference is that it's not future-looking. We need to make sure that we're preparing our health system for whatever happens next, that it's well-staffed, that we have the people who have gone through the COVID period and learned those lessons ready to go, that we're not losing our nurses overseas and that we have enough staff here who are really prepared to look after New Zealanders. I think his concerns are valid, and we need to do everything we can as a country to be prepared for whatever challenges we're facing coming up to the next generation. It's not something which is going to happen in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. We need to be constantly prepared for the next winter season to face more infectious disease, which is becoming more and more dangerous for our populations.
Should there also be special consideration given to how our most vulnerable populations were impacted by both the pandemic itself and lockdown?
I think that's a really good point, that vulnerable populations in New Zealand and all around the world were affected in ways that we couldn't have predicted, because we'd never dealt with something quite like this before. Yes, we need to consider how it affected everyone, especially young people. You know, there are a number of university students now, people who will be listening to this and also in their first jobs, who had to do a huge part of their schooling and education disconnected from their peers. We can do that better next time, because we have learned lessons about keeping those connections and about making forums for young people more accessible. It's also, you know, a huge set of learning that we have done about protecting elderly populations and people who have health vulnerabilities, and those are great things to bake into our medical system going forward.
Based on what has been recommended so far, what is Labor likely to take on board for future planning?
I think we're very lucky to have people like the Honourable Dr. Aisha Verrill, who is an infectious disease specialist, who also went through that period of really learning how to build out government capability quickly to respond to infectious disease, which is going to be really dangerous for our population. And also people like the Honourable Pēnei Henare, who led part of our Māori health response and working directly with Māori communities, building a vaccination workforce that was community responsive in sometimes rural areas, hard to reach, and working directly with marae. Those are incredibly useful experiences that both of them have had. In terms of our Pacific health response, I also think working directly with community groups and churches is something that we should bring to a range of our policies going forward. We're really lucky to have people who served through that period who have those expertise, and new people who are bringing the experience of working with community organisations directly on the ground to not only vaccinate, not only make sure that people had what they needed in the community, but also work with those networks that grew up around a time where people were in crisis and can now be used going forward for the benefit of those communities and neighbourhoods.
An expert group has made a series of recommendations on what climate adaptation legislation could look like. Do you see a strong need for this kind of legislation?
I'm really enthusiastic about the sort of recommendations that the expert group has made, but I don't think we are well prepared with this government to take those recommendations forward and really focus on what needs to be done here. We're talking about huge challenges for my generation and yours, Caden, if we don't get this right, and we need to make sure that our law, our regulatory settings, our council rules, everything is set up to respond to the real threat of things like flooding, slips, the changes in weather patterns, so that we can continue to live in our cities and towns.
The report notes that climate change poses a special risk to both low socioeconomic communities and Māori. Are these important considerations when drafting climate adaptation legislation?
I think so. I chaired a select committee inquiry. It was incredibly cross-partisan on the Māori response to climate adaptation in the last term. It was an honour and a privilege to do that. I did it alongside people like Todd Muller, as well as Tama Pōtaka, now serving as a minister in this government. We came up with a set of recommendations about having listened to submitters who were from iwi, from marae, from communities that were rural, about how we should be taking into effect Māori land as well as a Māori worldview when it comes to really important questions around communities that need to adapt. The theme was this, that we need government, community organisations and those people who are affected at the table as early as possible, coming up with not only solutions that are proactive and infrastructure based, things like building say seawalls or changing the way that rivers flow through towns, but also then making the investments to allow these people to be more resilient in their homes, or if they choose to adapt in a different way, to be able to do that so that they have a sense of community going forward. It's not going to work for vulnerable communities if government from the top tells them what to do without working with them directly, and we have to plan for this, because it's going to affect a huge number of people in the coming years.
The expert group has also recommended an end to government buyouts for homes damaged by extreme weather events. What is your response to this recommendation?
Well, I was disappointed to see that not coming along with a number of other recommendations that are sort of already playing out on the ground. Councils are well ahead of that sort of recommendation. And I see this as a government burying its head in the sand and pretending there aren't more issues that it could be dealing with directly. But hopefully this report and that finding particularly is a bit of a wake-up call for them, especially the constituency MPs within the National Party who represent communities, because that will be very confrontational for a lot of people. But that is the sort of response that we're going to have if we don't also have other responses in place. We saw recently the Auckland Council having to buy out flood-damaged properties, and they have recently come to some conclusions around the number of those that, with a bit of remediation, have some commercial value. It is a very low number. So we're seeing that, you know, with government needing to step in and help people really badly affected by these situations, if we don't have proactive planning in place and if we aren't allowing for communities to be involved at the beginning of that planning process, then we end up with a really bad situation sort of at the end of it, an ambulance at the bottom of the cliff where government is stepping in and there's not commercial value associated with the properties that are sold. And, you know, what does this mean to young people listening? It means that we will not be able to deal with the challenges that are going to affect us when we are homeowners, when we are renters with families, if we don't actually take steps now to decide what is a fair way to distribute government help, distribute government resources, not just across the country, but across time. We can't afford really gold-plated solutions now if it means that in future there's going to be no government help associated whatsoever, which is what this report is sort of pointing to.
Labor notably didn't implement climate adaption legislation last time you were in power. Is addressing these climate change issues a priority heading into the next election?
I'd challenge that. I think the work for climate adaptations, not only legislation but also in regulation and with councils, was absolutely begun, and we made really great progress on that as a government. The National Environmental Standards, as well as the spatial planning law championed by people like the Honourable Rachel Brooking, really useful. We know that we need to do more work. This is not a three-year problem to solve. This is something that will take a decade to get right. But yes, we have planning and work underway around how climate change and climate adaptation is becoming a real problem for things like insurance, and could leave people without a home at all in future. We're especially concerned about those vulnerable communities, and we are the Labor Party. We believe that our solutions and when government intervenes, things should be fairer for people, especially those communities that need help. And so we're planning around how we make it possible for first-time buyers, for vulnerable communities, for people with disabilities, for people who are in renting situations with children, to get a fair outcome when they're affected by things like flooding, slips, sea level rises, those things that we know are coming for people.
That was Labor's Arena Williams on phase two of the Royal Commission inquiry into COVID-19 and recommendations from an independent advisory group on climate adaptation legislation.
That was our weekly chat with the Labor Party.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
This month, a number of council body reforms have come into effect in the Auckland Council, fulfilling Mayor Wayne Brown's promise to address issues and implement community feedback into the council's format. The three new divisions in the Auckland Council to improve organisation include the Auckland Urban Development Office, the Property Department, and an Economic Development Office, each of which are intended to make decision-making more effective and accessible to the public. As well, with the persisting cold temperatures and rainy weather hitting Auckland this winter, I wanted to discuss the topic of homelessness in Auckland city centre and to what extent the council is working to support those rough sleeping in the CBD. I spoke with Councillor Shane Henderson this morning about both of these topics, starting with my questions on the council reforms. Firstly, can you talk a bit about what changes have been made to the Auckland Urban Development Office and the benefits the council hopes these will produce?
Yeah, totally. So there's been a real desire from the public to look at our council-controlled organisations like Eke Panuku, which was in charge of the urban development of Auckland, and how can we make them more sort of democratically accountable and look to bring services back in-house. So that's been a huge piece of work over the last year. And what it's resulted in now is what's called the Urban Development Office, which is sited within council, but will have kind of, I think, the flexibility to deal in the kind of property transactions that's needed for that kind of office. And hopefully this will result in a really exciting time for residents and communities to kind of see on the ground some of the great work that they have already done as in their previous iteration and will continue to do.
What have been some of the main issues the council body reforms have sought to address with relation to Auckland transport?
Yeah, so it sort of goes back to that feelings of accountability again, and that communities are feeling that they're not listened to, or their words are not sort of taken on board and allowing sort of changes through what their feedback is. And so what can we do about that? Well, one of the things that we've looked at is through the CCO reform, as I said, bringing in services back in-house where it makes sense. And I think a lot of Aucklanders would say that the policy functions of Auckland Transport really cuts to the heart of what democratic accountability and democracy really is, and would expect councillors to be directing that with the help of the residents. So, yeah, so basically what's come in-house through AT is kind of a policy situation so that we can direct things a little bit firmer on the ground for people, yeah.
Yeah, you're talking a bit about some concerns coming from the community. Can you talk a bit about how some of this public feedback has been incorporated into the reforms, and are you happy with how Auckland Council has managed this public feedback process?
Yeah, look, I'm delighted with how it's all turning out, and I think the feedback so far is looking pretty good through the channels that I've sort of heard. Look, very, very happy with it. I think it's a great day when we can increase democratic accountability. The challenge with transport specifically is that, you know, Aucklanders have very high opinions and strong opinions about how they feel things should be. Sometimes those can be in conflict. So that's why you elect politicians. And if you don't like those politicians, you can replace them with new ones every 3 years, right? And so this is kind of what the reforms are designed to do.
What are your hopes for the regional deal between Auckland and the central government, and what will be the council's priorities going into negotiations?
Yeah, exciting new frontier for the city, the regional deal. My personal hope is that we're having a strong focus on economic development because, you know, our region is a huge contributor nationally to GDP. I think it's about 38% of the country's GDP comes from Auckland. But people are struggling out there and our unemployment is going up. And we kind of have the solutions here with, you know, many industries in Auckland that are doing fantastically that need some sort of extra help and extra support from central government. And I'm thinking things like tourism. I'm thinking major events funding. That's a big issue for the city. And I'm even thinking things, you know, the West Auckland, like our screen industry that's had some fantastic help that needs to kind of continue and strengthen as much as we can. So, you know, it's up to us to kind of create jobs here. I think that through a regional deal framework, we can do that.
For my second topic, I wanted to talk about something that is quite important to me, I think. We're quite a big city, Auckland, and we're right in the middle of winter. Homelessness is an ever-present and quite visible issue, particularly in the city centre. How has Auckland Council been responding to, this year in particular, rising numbers of homeless people, especially rough sleeping in the CBD?
Yeah, I spoke last night on this topic, actually, at a public event, and that was pretty pretty good. In terms of homelessness, we've got to take a really strong approach because housing is a fundamental human right, and it's something that any city leader, any country leader should be taking first and trying to tackle the issue as much as we can. Because, you know, as we say, housing is kind of the everything problem. If you don't have secure, warm, dry housing that's available to you, then that has flow-on effects to all manner of things, your health and well-being, family time, etc. What's council doing about it? Well, we do fund groups and fund things to kind of do work on the ground there and coordinate efforts. I think that funding should be continuing. But there is a wider conversation for our city, and that's that we need to ensure housing supply and in the right places. So that's one of the missions that sort of I have and many other politicians have as well, is that we've got to be making sure that our housing supply is up to scratch so that we can actually get our homeless into homes.
Do you think the government's recent changes to eligibility for emergency housing, which do make it more difficult to access, are justified?
No, I think it's a huge concern. I think that we should be doubling down on public housing and emergency housing rather than looking to restrict it or to kind of reduce its availability at all. You know, I think that homelessness, to be honest, is a policy choice by politicians, and we can choose to fix this problem or come a long way toward doing so anyway. And these kind of moves, I think, are really a wrong step, and it's something that I thoroughly oppose.
Are you concerned about the extent to which funding and decision-making in the homelessness sector draws somewhat from the central government, when it is clear that much of the mahi and knowledge comes from grassroots groups and the community itself?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that enabling groups on the ground and communities on the ground to solve the issue, that's the way forward. And you can see when we're funding these fantastic groups that are doing really great work, they have huge results. And so a bottom-up approach rather than a top-down approach, that's exactly what we should be doing. And Council stands ready as a strong partner in that, I believe, because we have the knowledge and the communication and the networks. We're on the ground in the biggest city of New Zealand to solve this issue. So, look, stronger partnerships between central and local government is a really great thing, but that should be for the purpose of funding and supporting the community groups that are doing the hard work.
How, if at all, has homelessness been considered in Auckland Council's plans for housing and business intensification in the CBD and general future planning?
Look, I think I'm not, first I'm just saying it for myself, not enough. I think, honestly, that we should be taking a supply-first approach to this, because, you know, the evidence is quite clear that if you increase supply actually in any kind of typology of housing, then that has flow-on effects for that entire market, and it does get homelessness into housing that frees up and becomes available. And so, honestly, we are getting better and better in terms of that supply conversation, and I'm really proud of that. But I think we've got to just make sure that we keep our homeless community in the front of our minds, because they're the Aucklanders that are really doing it so tough, and we've got to help them out.
That was Shane Henderson speaking about recent reforms to Auckland Council bodies, as well as concerns around homelessness in the city centre.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree?
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B. This is some Blood Orange.
Yeah. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk.
Our go.
United States President Donald Trump's mega spending bill passed its final vote in the House of Representatives and is now set to become law. The bill, nicknamed the Big Beautiful Bill, focuses on spending and taxes. It has been highly controversial, mainly because it could add $3.3 trillion to federal deficits over the next decade and cut health insurance for millions. Overall, the bill significantly increases spending for tax cuts, defense, and border security, while cutting spending on Medicaid, green energy, and food benefits. Despite its controversy and universal opposition from the Democrats, the bill has been supported by the vast majority of Republicans. For International Desk, I spoke to Associate Professor of Political Science at Boise State University in Idaho, Charlie Hunt, about the bill and Republican support.
Sure. There are a few main areas that received most of the controversy and that generated a lot of pushback from Democrats, some Republicans, and interestingly from Elon Musk, of all people. One big area were the cuts to Medicaid, which is the U.S.'s system for getting health care to poor Americans. A lot of the really drastic cuts came in that program, and that got a lot of pushback, particularly from Democrats and from some Republicans in states and districts that have lots of Americans living in poverty. Another big area was in terms of the debt and deficit. By just about any measure, this bill would explode the debt in the U.S., which is already pretty significant, by anywhere from $3 to $5 trillion. This was a big source of pushback from Democrats, from some Republicans, and from Elon Musk, who, of course, was involved in the DOGE effort in the U.S. earlier this year. And another one of Musk's points that he was pushing was on the green energy tax credits that originated in the Biden administration and that were significantly rolled back in this legislation. And obviously, Democrats were very upset about that as well. So those are just a few of the key areas.
Why then has there been so much support for this bill from the majority of Republicans?
The big reason is that the vast majority of Republicans in Congress were elected in districts and in states that themselves voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump in, you know, at least the last election and probably all three of the last presidential elections over the past decade or so. This hasn't always been the case. So it used to be back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that, you know, Democrats in Congress would regularly get elected in districts that actually supported Republican presidents like Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon. And likewise, there were plenty of Republicans who got elected in districts that supported Democrats for president like Lyndon Johnson or Bill Clinton. But that's less and less the case. That's been trending downward in recent years. Now, in this past election that we had in the U.S. in 2024, only 16 out of 435 congressional districts in the U.S. House of Representatives feature a member of Congress who was elected in a district won by the opposing party for president. And so what this means is that for the vast majority of members of Congress, including all these Republicans, their incentives are aligned with supporting Donald Trump. And more they are elected or reelected on that basis, that even if this bill was not popular nationwide, it's popular among supporters of President Trump, who are then going to use, you know, whether or not that member supported Trump as an excuse to vote for them or not vote for them.
What has the Democrats' strategy been to oppose this bill, and have they had any success?
They have focused a great deal on the Medicaid cuts. Polling indicates that is a big issue for voters, and that a lot of the Republican members of Congress who are going to be running for re-election next year in 2026, who are vulnerable, they're in districts maybe that Donald Trump won, but just won by a couple of points. They're going to face really tough challenges, and they are going to face ads and all kinds of pushback from Democrats on the Medicaid portion. I do think that's the biggest motivator. I think that a lot of Americans say they don't want America to go deeply into debt or to rack up debt that they owe to other countries. But I also think it's something that maybe Americans say they care about, but is not necessarily something that's going to motivate them to the polls. It's hard to tell how much success Democrats have had yet. I mean, the American public is pretty vastly opposed to this legislation. My question going forward is whether, you know, the midterm election is well over a year from now. Is it possible that Democrats can keep this in the news, keep this at the focus of voters' attention by this time next year when voters are actually going to start paying attention to the election?
What is the timeline for the bill's implementation? And do you expect we'll see continued partisan division over it?
I certainly expect we'll see continued partisan division over it, and including as the bill is implemented. You know, presidents before Trump, including Joe Biden with his Inflation Reduction Act, you know, President Obama with the Affordable Care Act, the bigger the bill is, the longer it usually takes to get implemented. Not only do you have to, you know, get everybody on board and sign the legislation and all that, you need to organize the bureaucracy within the executive branch of the federal government to actually put these things into place. Now, in some cases, you know, with the tax cuts, that can be handled pretty immediately. That's something that's going to show up in, you know, next year's tax bills for when Americans go to pay their taxes. But a lot of these other ones are going to take some significant time to implement. And a lot of times, I mean, this was the case with Biden, for example. He put through these, you know, renewable energy tax credits and all kinds of programs to help spur along the renewables industry. But then he was out of office 2 years later, and now Donald Trump is rolling all of that stuff back, either legislatively or through executive orders. And so the speed with which the administration puts this stuff into place is going to matter. But a lot of these other portions, especially the less popular ones, like the Medicaid cuts, they are trying to delay until after the election if they possibly can, because they understand they're not popular. So some of these are going to take even longer to put into place.
Does this mean the ramifications of this bill will be felt for a long time, perhaps even well beyond Trump's presidency?
Oh, I think so. I mean, for sure, if you're talking about the Medicaid cuts, those are going to have really long-term impacts in terms of, you know, lifting people out of poverty or not. If we're talking about the cuts to green energy and renewable energy, you know, we're already seeing, we've just come through a week in the U.S. where we've had these really deadly floods in Texas that almost certainly have been exaggerated on account of climate change. And as climate is, it is not going away as an issue. And so the more you are sort of delaying this transition into a green energy economy on the political side, the more you are going to see these consequences down the road. The question is whether Democrats can really make the point significantly enough to have it matter electorally so that Republicans sort of feel the pain politically going forward.
That was Associate Professor at Boise State University, Charlie Hunt, on Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill that will radically overhaul federal spending in the United States.
International Desk on 95 BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts, 5395. This is LCD Sound Systems, North American Scum, rather appropriately.
It'll make it okay.
makes it go away. Oh, I don't know, oh, where to begin when we're North American, but in the end make the same mistakes all over again.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
This week's second phase of the National COVID-19 Inquiry has seen public hearings from the community and experts talking about the wider impacts of mandates and lockdowns during the pandemic. As health experts are urging the government to anticipate and better prepare for a future pandemic, and people in all sectors across New Zealand still work through the ongoing effects of COVID-19, this inquiry needs to inform critical decision-making and processes for the central government. Speaking more about the inquiry and the general effects of COVID-19, I spoke with public health expert Sir Colin Tukuitonga about his research findings and the importance of pandemic preparedness, as well as Restaurant Association Chief Executive Marissa Bidois about the need to support businesses and hospitality in New Zealand. My first interview is with Marissa Bidois. So we've got this phase two of the COVID inquiry this week. I wanted to ask you first off, are you optimistic that the government will be receptive to community feedback going into this phase of the COVID inquiry?
Look, I think that it's really important that they are. And I do think that this is why we're having the COVID inquiries is to hear the feedback and hopefully learn from that. I think it's absolutely essential, you know, that that the community are able to, I guess, share their experiences of COVID. Everyone experienced it in a different way. And it is a really opportune time to learn about what went well, what didn't go well, and hopefully have a plan for the future.
You've written about this topic before. What were some of the main issues that you wanted to highlight, especially for restaurants and businesses in terms of the effect of COVID and the mandates that happened during that time?
Yeah. Well, I just want to start with saying, look, there were some things that went really well. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that as well. Things like the wage subsidy helped businesses. Many businesses survived during a really difficult time. But on the flip side of that, you know, there are things that didn't go so well. And I think one of the things that we have been highlighting the most is just that need for early consultation with the communities that are impacted the most. Like, say, for example, our industry, hospitality, we felt that there were a lot of things that we could have done early in the piece to assist with the response. For example, we had a plan around the contactless delivery right from the very start. This was eventually implemented way down the track, but it could have been implemented sooner if there would have been early engagements.
Are there any perspectives or issues that you think should be highlighted, especially in this inquiry, or that you think have been dismissed or undervalued in discourse around the effect of COVID-19?
Look, I think there are absolutely so many different areas that, you know, can be examined and reviewed. One of the things that I think is really important from our perspective as an industry, hospitality businesses did have quite restrictive rules put on them when compared to other industries, for example. This did lead to the loss of, you know, many businesses in our industry. So I think a one-size-fit approach doesn't work. It really does need to be tailored. It does need to be looked at carefully in terms of how blanket policy impacts people. I know that's not always practical, and sometimes we need to kind of respond quickly, but I think it's really important to, yeah, just consider the nuances of how blanket policy impacts individuals and industry.
Are there any examples that you know of from other countries in terms of the responses, the mistakes and successes that you think New Zealand could be using to inform our inquiry and recommendations for the future?
Look, I think we can always learn from what's happened overseas and sort of examine some of the different approaches that were made. For example, we were really quite fond of, the UK's approach, some of the things that the government did over there to support the hospitality industry. They were heavily invested in the impacts that had on their industry. You know, they had sort of subsidized dining available for the public. We really liked that. We thought that would have worked really well in New Zealand and could have sort of boosted the trade within our businesses after that kind of lockdown period. So we thought that went down really well. But of course, there will be people who don't agree with that as well. So we realize that everyone has different viewpoints.
A bit of a sidebar question. Do you have any concerns, especially with this phase of the inquiry, in terms of politicization to the effect of potentially overshadowing the genuine impacts faced by people across Aotearoa?
Sorry, let me just hear the question again. Are you sort of asking by having this inquiry, are we kind of getting lost in the politics? Is that kind of what we're...
Do you have concern, that political parties are using it to kind of push criticism against each other or say, you did this wrong or we could have done this better, that kind of thing?
I think I genuinely would like to believe that we can learn something from examining past actions. I mean, yes, I guess it is an opportunity to kind of highlight, hey, you didn't do this well. We would have done it better. You know, it does kind of lend itself to that. But in the grand scheme of things, I think Aotearoa will benefit from examining the processes, the policies, and how those decisions were made. I think we can only benefit from examining that.
In the case of a future pandemic of any similar scale to what we've observed with COVID, how do you think the government could act differently to better support businesses while appropriately balancing public health needs?
One of the things that we put forward is having a standing advisory group collectively from businesses to shape policy procedure around emergency response plans, and we think this is sort of something that could work quite well. I think that these sorts of circumstances, we have to remember it was a unique point in time. We hadn't really sort of dealt with anything quite like this before. So of course there are going to be mistakes that were made, things that have impacted people adversely, but I think the most important thing is that if we can learn from this and do better, that's going to be a really good outcome for everyone.
Next up, I spoke with public health expert and Pacific academic Sir Colin Tukuitonga on his thoughts about phase two of the COVID inquiry. Are you satisfied with the proceedings of the COVID-19 inquiry this week?
Oh, I thought the original inquiry, in fact, pretty much summarised the overall situation in New Zealand. The so-called phase two is clearly targeted at certain aspects, as you say, vaccine mandates and so on. So, I suppose Aotearoa New Zealand will find information that hopefully will inform us to do better next time. I have to say I'm not sure that phase two is necessary. I thought the information that came out in the original inquiry was more than enough, and I would just hope that we act on those and plan ahead, because most experts tell us that we can expect another pandemic in the future. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm ambivalent about the value of the second phase, to be honest.
So you don't think that we needed a second phase? Are you concerned about the COVID inquiry being used as an opportunity by political parties to levy criticism against one another rather than critically inform and improve New Zealand's pandemic preparedness?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, if you look at the terms of reference for phase two, it's clearly targeted at mandates, and it's something that political parties have pushed for. And given the way the terms of reference is structured, you can predict what's going to say. It's not as open-ended as I thought the original inquiry was, but anyhow, let's see what they come up with.
You were the lead researcher for a report on the impact of the COVID-19 response for Pacific communities. Can you tell me a bit about your findings relating to the failure of certain decisions to adequately meet the needs of Pacific and Māori populations?
Yes, we did three reports, actually. One was funded by the Health Research Council and the other two by the Ministry of Health. And obviously we... came to the the studies looked in depth at how particularly Pacific communities got on during the pandemic. I should say that Māori and Pacific people are disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. There's no great surprise. What is a surprise, of course, is that we didn't learn the lessons of history. In the 1918 influenza pandemic, Māori were found to have six times the death rate of Pākehā in New Zealand. In other words, we knew back in 1918 that Māori in Indigenous Māori who were disproportionately affected by these outbreaks, and I would have thought that we would have been better prepared. I'm also on the record as saying that I thought New Zealand did pretty well overall in terms of the response we had to COVID-19 compared to other countries elsewhere in the world, and I thought we did really well as a country. What we didn't do so well, of course, was fully engage in support Māori communities and Pacific communities, and as a result, they were disproportionately affected. More infections per unit population, more hospitalizations, and more deaths comparatively. And so in a way, one could say we should have known better, but we didn't, and we didn't do so well in protecting Indigenous Māori and Pacific people. A number of reasons for that we can go into, but as I say, that's pretty much what our studies found.
Do you think there's been sufficient attention offered to the longer-term effects of COVID-19, especially for populations who have faced disproportionate consequences on their livelihoods?
Well, my understanding, one of the criticisms of the original inquiry was that there wasn't enough attention and focus given to people who suffered long COVID. And I understand that even in phase two, again, it's not part of the, it's not a big component of the inquiry. And people who suffer long-term consequences of COVID-19 would say that their voices have not been allowed for, and they may well have a point. I guess my main concern, of course, is the fact that the impact on Pacific people, both short-term in terms of socioeconomic impacts, access to health services, uptake of vaccines, need to be better accounted for next time. I'm not at all disregarding the importance of long COVID, but I think in both components of the inquiry, my understanding is the long COVID is not a big part of those inquiries.
What would be your recommendations for the government, both in terms of ensuring that this inquiry is effective in addressing the concerns of people across New Zealand and ensuring that we are prepared for a future pandemic and have general pandemic preparedness measures?
Well, my advice would be to take due account of the important and useful information that came out in phase one. There was a lot of good information and advice there to inform us as a country to for us to be better prepared for the next pandemic. I'm sure the phase two inquiry with a focus on vaccine mandates, for example, and very specific topics that were perhaps not as well covered in phase one. That, again, I'm sure we'll learn some things from there, provided we don't use the findings of phase two to continue to press and score political points. And that's my fear with phase two, because it's quite the terms of reference is quite specific and clearly motivated by people who subscribe to a particular political party. It's the risk with phase two, in my view.
That was Pacific Public Health Expert Sir Colin Tikuitonga and Restaurant Association Executive Marissa Bidois sharing their views on this week's COVID-19 inquiry.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kororo mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Arena Williams, Boys State University's Charlie Hunt, Councillor Shane Henderson, Restaurant Association Executive Marissa Bidoi, and Sir Colin Tukuitonga. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.